I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Hurricanes and tornadoes and landslides are a costly and dangerous problem, but rust is even more destructive and expensive, but rarely gets the attention of natural disasters. It's a slow-moving threat to our infrastructure, to industry, and the military. In fact, the Pentagon has a rust czar whose job it is to prevent and fight corrosion and has saved taxpayers billions of dollars. Our guest, Jonathan Waldman, is the author of a new book called Rust, The Longest War. It's about the people who have dedicated their lives to fighting this insidious threat. He has written for Outside, The Washington Post, McSweeney's. Rust is his first book. And Jonathan Waldman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
So why a book about rust, something we all have such an intimate knowledge of?
Well, it was all born on a sailboat. As I like to say, it started with a very bad decision, and that was to purchase an old 30-year-old 40-foot sailboat with two adventurous buddies of mine.
And what happened? Yeah, what did rust do?
I guess I pretty much drained my bank account and nearly tore my hair out combating rust for a couple years out in San Francisco. Along the way, I did a little journalistic trick. I figured, well, maybe I'll feel better about my problems if I look at the Navy's rust problems. And until then, I'd never thought about the Navy's rust problems. But I ended up in Norfolk, Virginia at a conference called Mega Rust, which is paid for by our tax dollars. And at Mega Rust, I met the nation's corrosion czar, Dan Dunmire, and I also met a bunch of admirals telling me that they see rust as the number one threat to the most powerful Navy on Earth. So that's when it kind of clicked, and I said, I think there's something here.
Well, and there's so many interesting people, I have to say, involved in combating rust. Daniel Dunmire, being one of them, he's head of, and this is his title, the Pentagon's Corrosion Policy and Oversight Office. You say he has saved this country billions of dollars. How has he done that?
So this is not, and this is not just me. This is according to the General Accountability Office. Dan Dunmire likes to say that his office is the most scrutinized in the Pentagon. And I don't know if that's exactly the case, but he's always defending what he does. But he says, you know, you have to spend millions to save billions. And so they've looked at some of the projects his office has funded, and they've done something like a couple hundred projects over the last dozen years. And about a third of them have to do with paints, but a lot of them have to do with solving rust problems, or at least mitigating them before they just spiral out of control and gobble up maintenance money. And the GAO has estimated that his projects return somewhere around 14-1 return on investment.
And we're talking about ships and planes and tanks, I guess anything metal that the Pentagon is involved in.
Yeah, and I maybe this is unsaid, but the subtext of the book is that our Defense Department, they love metal things. That's the strongest
they
stuff
do. But so, you say an interesting thing. First of all, he seems to have a very suspicious view of manufacturers. He said they just want to break stuff, but part of every defense contract now includes some kind of rust prevention control.
Yeah, when I met him at this conference, he really surprised me. I expected our nation's corrosion czar to be an engineer, and he's not. He studied public administration. He's actually completing his master's now. Sorry, his PhD now, after many years away from school. And he's, I think, like most guys, he started thinking, well, technical solutions are going to be the key. And he said, no, it's cultural. We got to think long term. We got to stop buying stuff and not being surprised when it breaks 5 years later. We can't put up with that. And at first, I think a lot of people in the Defense Department resisted. They said, "What? Not an engineer? Like, we need a chemist in there." And luckily, his superior understood that this was not a technical matter. This was a cultural matter. So what Dan Dunmire has tried to do is weave corrosion, as he says, into the fabric of the Pentagon. Now, every project coming in from the president's new helicopter to the space fence, it has to address corrosion before it can proceed. And that's thanks to Dan Dunmire.
And it seems that these and they're largely men, largely men with mustaches, as you write, Johnny, that it's these, there are certain kind of cast of characters that seem to have a kind of obsession and interest in fighting rust.
Yeah, so the mustache thing is funny. I'm certainly not the only writer to think mustaches are kind of, whatever, quirky and funny. But I think I also chose them, and I say this explicitly in the book, because, you know, shaving is this endless battle. You cannot,
sort of like rust, right?
Yeah, exactly like rust. So there are these guys who are engineers, and it's funny to me that they've kind of given up trimming their upper lips because, it's going to come back tomorrow anyway. And probably because they spend enough of their time and energy fighting a much bigger force that maybe they don't have much fight left in them when they go home to look in the mirror. I don't know. And so much stuff is so slick and modern today that mustaches, they remind me of when I was a kid or something.
Yeah, I mean, you do see mustaches around, but it's interesting that from your perspective, they seem to have this thing in common. What else do they have in common besides this desire to fight rust?
That's a good question. Some of them... I hate to pick on engineers, but forgive me a little bit here, because a lot of my friends are engineers. But there's a somewhat famous saying about engineers that even the most outgoing will look at your shoes while talking to you. And the good news was for this book that I did find a number of engineers who were way more outgoing than that and actually conversed in real English while looking eye to eye and could tell me things I didn't know about and share with me worlds I hadn't seen before. But there are a lot of them who are sort of strictly technical, the cliche, like pocket protectors,
sure,
and pens and cell phones on the holsters on their belts. And that's all fine and good. What else do they have in common?
They seem to have this sort of passion, intense passion to keep rust at bay.
Yeah, they're definitely obsessed, and there's no better gift for a writer than to find obsessed people. So I hope, as a reader, I hope you enjoyed reading about people who are quite obsessed.
I did. In fact, I'd love to have you read a poem. This is on page 188. It's a poem titled Rust's a Must, and it was delivered at a Rust conference of some sort. I wonder if you could read that for us, Johnny.
Of course. Do you, a little warning about who it's by. It's by Tom Watson, who was the head of the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, and I identify him as pretty much the one of the funniest rust or corrosion engineers in history. So here's what he wrote in 1974. Mighty ships upon the ocean suffer from severe corrosion. Even those that stay at dockside are rapidly becoming oxide. Alas, that piling in the sea is mostly Fe2O3. And when the ocean meets the shore, you'll find there's Fe3O4. Because when the wind is salt and gusty, things are getting awful rusty. We can measure, we can test it, we can halt it or arrest it, we can gather it and weigh it, we can coat it, we can spray it. We examine and dissect it, we cathodically protect it. We can pick it up and drop it, but heaven knows we'll never stop it. So here's to rust, no doubt about it. Most of us would starve without it.
It's actually a great little poem.
He's good. He's great.
It's great.
There's a funny thing at the end. There's a little snipe in there about starving without it. And I think that's sort of what Dan Dunmire's fighting. He said, well, yeah, there are some engineers who want things to break, so they always have maintenance to do. And we need to get in there and sort of change that. I went to the National Association of Corrosion Engineers conference, and I noted it's a lot of oil and gas guys, but there are no plumbers there. And for what it's worth, I guess it sort of seems like the plumbing industry might be, I hate to say, well, I won't use the word, but they might be the ones who cheer the most at all this maintenance work that comes their way regularly.
Well, that is certainly how they make their living. Let me go back. And part of the thesis of your book is that we spend a lot of time, a lot of TV time, if there's some kind of a natural disaster or a hurricane, and for probably mostly the right reasons. But you say rust, which of course works slowly and quietly, is actually what, more destructive than some of these natural disasters that have wreaked so much havoc in this country?
Yeah, it's sort of... it's chronic. It doesn't have the drama that volcanoes or flat, tsunamis or rogue waves have. But it does. It's costlier than all the other disasters combined, and we get caught up in it's the nature of time. Maybe we see things that happen on a certain scale and we go, oh my God, that's so scary. But you go out every day and you see your car a little bit worse than before. It doesn't register as scary.
Well, and it's, you know, as you say, it's this kind of chronic and slow moving process. There's a lot of talk about infrastructure today and rebuilding or refurbishing infrastructure. I'm assuming a fair amount of that has to do with just plain old rust.
Yeah, more than a fair amount. The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates, well, they gave our infrastructure an average of, I think it's a D minus.
Yeah, pretty low grade, as I recall.
Yeah, I'd say.
You also talk about the fact it would be interesting to have the Rust Channel. We don't have the Rust Channel. Sort of hard to imagine, you know, talking about watching paint dry. This would be talking about watching rust do its thing. But it sounds like what you're saying is it's time to pay more attention to this process.
Yeah. You know, the Rust Channel would make C-SPAN look like an action movie.
Definitely. Definitely.
And it's hard. It's what Dan Dunmire's up against. He wants to change the way we sort of process what's happening in the world. And I'm almost terrified that you said I have a thesis in the book. I tried to back away and do a lot of reporting. But it's probably the case that at the end, by the time we get to the end, I sort of do have a changed view of how we operate on Earth and kind of what it means to be stewards of things that we build.
Well, about a minute before our break here, can you give for our listeners, from your perspective, what you learned, what the corrosion process is?
Yeah, sure. So it's easy. So the most abundant element on Earth is attacking our most important material everywhere all the time. And it does this by desperately trying to steal electrons. And because we learned it in high school, we filed this reaction away as, you know, sort of boring and thought, well, I'll never need that information again. So I do sort of try to get the science behind me pretty quick in the book and then move on to the drama and to sort of think of it more as a force or even, you know, it's been called the evil or the great destroyer. So I prefer to move on from the reaction and get to what it does and how it operates than to focus on the chemistry.
And it has been called evil, the great destroyer, the pervasive menace. I mean, for people that have to deal with it, this is what they call it.
This is what they call it. It's true.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Yes, we are talking about rust in this hour of Radio Times. The reason being, Jonathan Waldman has written a new book about it. It's titled Rust, and it's subtitled The Longest War. And he has written for Outside. He's also written for The Washington Post, for McSweeney's. This is his very first book. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. If you want to join the conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And we'll be talking with a photographer in about 10 minutes or so. She takes beautiful photographs of the rust in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, at the steel factory there. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, and we are talking about rust. Rust costs the United States hundreds of billions of dollars a year, but this slow-moving and insidious threat to our nation's infrastructure rarely grabs our attention. And our guest, Jonathan Waldman, changes some of that in his new book called Rust, The Longest War. And again, to join our conversation, go to radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. John, I'd love to have you talk about this. His name is Bhaskar Nyogi. I don't know if I pronounced his name correctly or not, but he basically, his job, as you write, is to worry about the Trans-Alaska pipeline. First of all, did I say his name correctly?
Yeah, Bhaskar.
Bhaskar. And his job is, and this is the Trans-Alaska pipeline. It's about an 800-mile pipeline in Alaska.
Yep, and it goes from Prudhoe Bay at the northern end of the state all the way down to Valdez, which is the northernmost ice-free port on the West Coast. So that's where they ship the oil onto tankers and get it down to Washington and California to refine it.
And how did he wasn't born in this country. How did he end up in Alaska? What was the route he took?
He lived in a number of East African countries. His dad was a civil engineer. And as it happened, he had a family member who taught at Fairbanks. So He went to Fairbanks, studied. I think he double majored in two kinds of engineering there, and he stayed on for a master's. And he's the kind of guy, he's addicted to learning. I once asked him what he would do if he won the lottery, and he said he'd just take classes the rest of his life. And
really?
I don't doubt it. He's a really, really bright guy. And his title on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which is run by a company called Alyeska, his title when I met him 2 years ago was integrity manager. And in the oil industry, that means they don't really like the word rust. In fact, they call it black powder. But integrity manager is you're in charge of keeping the pipeline whole, which means you study all the things that happen in the pipeline and be sure you get out there with bulldozers and metal sleeves and take care of the pipeline before it leaks or spills.
In fact, he does something, and you know, frankly, I'd never heard of it. It's called pigging the pipe. How does that work?
It's so fun. So a pig, there's two kinds of pigs. I sort of think of them as managerial and janitorial. The janitorial ones are like big round squeegees, and they go through pipes sometimes every day, every week, every month, and they scrape the line clean. And they scrape it clean so that when you send the managerial kind, which is called a smart pig, it can actually use sensors to detect what's going on in the wall of the pipe. And they do this either with ultrasonics, the same way a pregnant woman gets an ultrasound, or they do it with what's called magnetic flux leakage, in which case they induce a magnetic current in the wall of the pipe, and the sensors in the robot, they detect any changes in the field, and as through an algorithm, they can interpret that data and figure out how thin or thick the wall is and if something's happening to it. And so this robot, they turn it on, they put it in the end of the pipe, and then they send it on its way like a huge spitball. You can't control it. You can't really stop it unless you get to a pump station. You don't get the data until it goes all the way to the other end of the pipe, and you pull it out, and then you download the data.
Wow. And how long? And we're talking 800 miles here. How long does that take?
Yeah, so the Alaska pipeline used to have 2 million barrels a day flowing through it, so it only took 4 days to make it 800 miles. But every year, the pipeline is spitting out less oil, so now it's only a quarter as much oil, and it actually takes 18 days to make it across the state. So where pigs once ran 7-minute miles, now they're basically walking. And this creates a big logistical problem. You want to track the pig as it goes through the pipe, because if it does get caught, you definitely want to attend to it quickly. It's a big deal to have a robot that weighs 5 tons in a giant tube made for transporting liquids. And also, you need to design that robot with really powerful batteries and a really, really big hard drive. And the Alaska pipeline is unique in that it's such a long stretch. It's almost unprecedented in the world of pipelines. A lot of pipelines will have what's called a pig launcher or a pig receiver every 40, 80 miles. And the Alaska pipeline, when I went up there, had there's one at mile 144, and then the next 660 miles are one straight shot.
Wow. And is it a straight shot?
Well, it's a straight shot, except it's also kind of a roller coaster. And this was the crux of the inspection they were doing up there. When this robot goes, so the pipeline goes over three mountain ranges, the Brooks, the Alaska Range, and the Chugach. And when it goes down those slopes, the robot can get going way too fast because the pipeline is no longer full of oil. It's kind of like a water slide. And a robot sliding way too fast can either, the sensors can break, or the whole thing can sort of shake and jar and rattle and wires come apart, or the whole thing can actually sort of smash and break, and then you've got this million-dollar robot in your pipeline, which is broken and not collecting the data you want. And it still takes you 20 days for it to pop out the other end, and then you go, oh, well, that didn't work, and so you try again.
Wow. Now, we're talking go ahead.
So when I went up there to see their pig run in 2013, and they do pig runs like this every few years, which is more often than every other pipeline company in the country. When I went up there in 2013, half of the pig runs over the last dozen years had failed. So the stakes, and that just meant they had to come back and do it again or even a third time. So the stakes were pretty high when I went up there.
And is the goal to look for rust? I mean, things that could cause problems with the pipeline and then leakages and spills and things like that?
Yeah. So since the pipeline began operating in 1977, on the mainline pipe, there has never been a leak attributed to corrosion, and Alyeska would be very happy to keep it that way. To their credit, they have kept it that way. But it's only because they do this sort of incredible maintenance program where they're hunting for problems and trying to solve them before nature sort of does its thing. It's unprecedented in the world of maintenance, and the Alaska Pipeline is one of the heaviest metal things in the Western Hemisphere. So from my perspective, a guy writing about rust, I thought, this is so cool. I want to see how this is done. And I was lucky. No one had ever really been granted access to the pipeline the way I had. I guess they must have figured, this guy, he just wants to know about rust. Okay.
Well, you learned a few things. You also had a piece recently in the New York Times about the Keystone XL pipeline, basically saying, look, if you know, however you feel about it, and it looks like you're sort of agnostic about it, the importance is, if it happens, to make sure that it's maintained. And I guess using some of this technology we've been talking about in Alaska to mitigate against the power of rust.
Exactly. And there's a lot of pipeline companies will say, well, our pipelines, they go from big to small, or they take tight turns, and they say, well, our pipelines are what they call, quote, unpiggable. And there's a conference in Texas about unpiggable pipelines. And you can go and you can listen to operators, you know, and their woes about their tough-to-inspect pipelines. But the fact is, all these things can be fixed, and it's a lot easier, I think, to inspect pipelines than to deal with trains or trucks. And the record shows pretty clearly that pipelines are an order of magnitude more reliable than trains, and trains are, if not one, then two orders of magnitude more reliable than trucks.
Well, as you say, though, that does require thorough inspections and enough inspectors to be able to do the job, obviously.
Right. And the thing about the inspectors is the federal government's pipeline inspection agency, they don't actually do the inspections. They just require them, and so they look at the information. And when I was up in Alaska, the guys from the federal agency, they were actually in the operations control center watching some of the data come in on screens, making sure that the pipeline operator didn't exert too much pressure on the pipeline, followed a bunch of rules, but really they weren't the guys doing it. They were just sort of watching.
Let me reintroduce you, and we have a second guest to join the conversation. That's Jonathan Waldman. He has a new book. It's called Rust, The Longest War. He's written for Outside, The Washington Post, McSweeney's. This is his first book, and I should add, one of the people that he profiles in this book, Rust, is Alicia Eve Shook. She grew up in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where her grandfather worked at the steel mill. She is a photographer whose work is about the abstract beauty of rust. In fact, we posted a few of her photos on our Facebook page. And Alicia Eve Shook, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Do we have her?
Where is she?
Do we have you, Alicia?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Very good.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
thanks
indeed.
For
no,
thank. Me.
No,
okay.
Very welcome. Thanks for joining us. And I have to say, I have been to the steel, what's left of the steel factory in Bethlehem, and it is a work of art. It is a piece of beauty. And I have to congratulate you on your absolutely beautiful photographs.
Well, thank you.
When and why did you begin photographing the Bethlehem, the sort of rusting hulk of the Bethlehem steel?
I was out on a bike ride one day, and it was drawn to the long shadows raking across the ruins. And I rode over on my bike, and I stood at the fence's edge, and I was just kind of mesmerized and drawn to the sight. And then a few days later, I went back down with my camera and ventured on.
Now, you live there. Was this kind of the first time you felt like, wow, that is some kind of work of art?
Well, I'd actually been there a year before and taken some photos. It was my first, taken my first photo class, and I got access to the site because some people were interested in opening a restaurant down there, and I took some images with a hotspot. And so I had been down there before, but really it was on that bike ride that I became really drawn to the site.
Johnny, you describe in a chapter in your book about going with Alicia through the steel factory, you know, it sounds like sort of half legally, half illegally, but going through the factory with her, how did she help you see rust differently?
Well, everyone I met for the book, they're all foes. They all can't stand it. They don't really want to, they barely want to use the word. They use euphemisms for it. And Alicia was just fascinated by it and couldn't get enough of it. And, you know, the oil guys, like I said, they call it black powder, and they couch the phrase Russ Hunter as integrity manager. Alicia had snuck into the steelworks nearly 400 times and still found it fascinating. And so I said, I got to see how this works.
Well, and what you see in your photographs, Alicia, is just, first of all, how sort of abstract they are, the colors, the textures. Is that what interests you?
Well, yeah, I mean, all of those things. And I mean, the bigger picture interests me, too. I mean, I was just enamored with the site itself, but also just that within all of this darkness, you know, I could find these amazing jewels or, you know, abstract imagery. And I just found it really fascinating that, you know, because there were times the lighting has to be right, the all these factors have to come into play to capture a really beautiful abstract. And there are many times when I'm at the site and it's anything but, you know, beautiful or, you know, the stuff that I end up capturing there. So it's kind of in stark contrast, and it's really, you know, just quite a wonderful experience when I come upon this beauty amidst of all of this ruin, which often, you know, if you look around or you go, and as Jonathan got to experience going there, you don't really, it's not, you know, it's not right in front of you. It's not immediate at all. You kind of have to look for it and find it. So
we have an email from John. He says, can they comment on the phrase I've heard before, beauty of decay? Philadelphia is very rusty in its decay, as many old cities are. Is there beauty in rust? Put that to you, Alicia.
Absolutely. Definitely. It's there. You have to be able to see it. And You know, as a photographer, you know, your lenses and your tools and capture it in the right light and frame it. But there's absolutely beauty in it.
You see that as well, Johnny?
Of course. It's Wallace Stevens who said death is the mother of beauty.
I mean, does it feel, that's interesting. I mean, kind of, it is the sort of slow decay, dying of a building, right, Johnny?
Yeah, and a number of people have written books about the steelworks, which were shut down in 95 when the U.S. steel industry was kind of in shambles. And the obvious way to describe the steelworks as shuttered or stark or depressing or, you know, covered in pigeon poop. But the great thing about what Alicia does is she sort of refuses to buy the standard line of, well, you know, if you tell me it looks terrible, it looks terrible. She said, well, I'll go see for myself.
Did you want to add something to that, Alicia? Go ahead.
Well, I actually had an experience where a videographer, acquaintance of mine, had said to me early on, you know, this project has been photographed. There's many people that have photographed Bethlehem Steel. I don't really think you have a project there. You know, kind of just downplaying what I was doing. And I, you know, kind of listened to what he said, but I didn't really care. I was just drawn. I found it really fascinating. I didn't ever know what would, you know, come of my work and the success of it, and that it would be in the New York Times and American Photo and all these other, you know, and that people would end up loving it and buying it, you know, big, beautiful prints in their homes. I had no vision of any of that. I was just fascinated by it and drawn to it. So.
And is it still as fascinating to you today as it was 10 years ago when you began?
Yeah, I mean, and when I first started, I had not even gone to photography school yet. That was right before when I first started exploring the Bethlehem Steel site. I was a year before I'd gone to RIT. And so, yeah, I definitely still find it fascinating. And the pictures are beautiful. You know, when you see them in print and when people buy my work and the response and the emails, it's just, you know, about how it transforms their space, and they can't believe that rust can be so beautiful. And this is straight photography. There's no manipulation or anything. You know, the colors are what the colors are. And so, yeah.
Alicia, I'm curious about how you get permission. I mean, it seems like you have gotten permission, but you don't always follow the rules. Can I say that on the radio?
Yeah, that's fine. No, they actually, yes, I did have access. Did get permission to the steel site, and I got access. I had given the developers at that time, Perucci and them, the shots that I took that day with the Hasselblad the first time I went down my first photo class. I'd actually won awards for that, too.
Wow.
I gave them 3-frame prints, beautiful black and white images, and I said, I'm going to RIT to study photography, and I would like to use this as, you know, part of my project and coursework. And they granted me access. And,
That's great. That's great.
But the access, I was supposed to stay on the roads and so forth. And then later on, when the SANSA come in and I met with their director of design.
This is the casino that's
like,
up
well,
there.
How did you get these photos, you know, because you obviously were not staying on the ground. And they're like, we won't even talk about it. But then they went and hired and contracted me to document the whole demolition of the buildings that they took down to build the structures that are there now.
So it sounds like a satisfied customer.
Yes, they were.
Jenny, we're almost up on a break here, but, you know, for you to sort of watch Alicia work, what did that look like?
Oh, it was just, you know, as compelling as it could be. I wish I'd had a GoPro in my head, but we're wandering around and looking out so you don't trip over something or fall down a hole or break through a fence. It was the hunt for rust, but it was sort of flipped backwards from every other bit of reporting I've done.
Well, we have to take a very short break. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. As I said, we put a couple of your photographs on our Facebook page, and they are beautiful. And thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Great. You're welcome. And that's Alicia Eve Sook, and she is a photographer, and she specializes in photographing rust. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Jonathan Waldman, author of a new book called Rust, The Longest War. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We will be right back. We'll be talking about CAN school after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We just said goodbye to Alicia Eve Sook, who takes beautiful photographs of rust at places like Bethlehem Steel. And again, we have posted a couple of her photographs on our Facebook page. Jonathan Waldman staying with us for the rest of the hour, author of a new book called Rust, The Longest War. And to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Johnny, just one thing, just to follow up on your experiences with Alicia in Bethlehem Steel in the old steel stacks there. You do describe, I guess, what, animals, maybe people that live in there, a couple of close calls. Can you just fill us in on that?
Yeah, so we're trying to stay under the radar. You know, you hop over this fence, you cross some train tracks first. And then there are security guards who roam the premises. I think there's also some copper thieves. I'm sure there's some, you know, crackheads or whatever kind of word you want to use for addicts who are hanging out in sketchy places. There's who knows what kind of elements hanging out there. And Alicia told me that the security guards, they told her once in pretty vivid terms, they said, you know, if you keep sneaking in here, eventually we're going to have to get cadaver dogs to find your corpse.
Wow.
So they're really trying to scare her and get her out of there and encourage her to not keep going, but she can't resist.
Well, clearly she can't resist. We have a couple of email questions. One is, and I don't know if you can do this, Johnny, or not, can you describe the difference between red and black rust? Why is it that you have two dissimilar metals that the corrosion is much worse? Or can you do that one?
Yeah, I think it has to do with how much, I forget if it's either water or air, but one is Fe2O3 and one is Fe3O4. And it's actually in that poem in seawater, you get one instead of the other.
Another comment from Chris says, is there any use for actual rust? You write about the rust store in Wisconsin.
Yeah, but the rust store doesn't sell rust.
No, I understand that. Right.
It sells products that you can use to fight rust
exactly.
Wherever you are. I heard a guy last week who told me that there's some water purification thing using rust. I don't know what that is. There are little packets. This isn't quite rust, but this might be the best use going for preserving artifacts in museums or time capsules. You want to keep oxygen out because oxygen, you know, that's what it does. It pretty much tries to steal electrons from everything. And so to do this, you put these little sachets, they're little white baggies of iron filings that haven't yet reacted with oxygen. And the idea is that they will rust and absorb oxygen and keep whatever artifacts you have in pristine condition. So I guess in that way, rust can be pretty useful.
Well, let's talk about the aluminum can, and let's fill it with, what, Coke?
Yeah, let's fill it with basically battery acid.
Well, right. And the question is, how does a can contain this very corrosive material?
Right. So for a couple hundred years now, cans have been marvelous things. And I guess what happens to every generation is we just sort of take for granted what we were given. But to our grandparents, a can, especially even a can of beer, would have just been almost mind-blowing. But you and I have seen them so many times, we just say, oh, a can, and then we toss it in the recycling and call it good. But a can is, it might be the most engineered thing on Earth, and it's so close to perfect, it's almost incredible. And one of the things that's incredible is how you keep battery acid like Coke or Mountain Dew from corroding a layer of aluminum that's basically a couple thousandths of an inch thick in what would normally be 3 days. And this is accomplished by using an epoxy spray, which the industry calls an internal coating. So an aluminum can is really a plastic container held up with aluminum around it. But we don't like to think of the plastic. We think of the aluminum. And to this stuff, a can is worth about a dime. And the epoxy coating inside it costs about half a penny.
Huh.
So in the scheme of things, they really don't want to use too much, and they don't want to use too little, otherwise the cans blow up or corrode. And I went to can school here in Colorado. It's put on by the world's largest can maker, and it's an industry-only event. And again, I must have this knack for sneaking into places unnoticed. But I heard them talk about cans as a time bomb, and that's how I knew that corrosion really was this huge threat to cans, and that they've basically mastered the art of keeping the product or the corrosive beverage from touching the aluminum.
But we're talking about BPA, right? Which there's certainly some questions raised about the safety of BPA.
Yeah, that's the controversial endocrine disruptor. Turns out the internal coatings are basically 80% BPA. It's what makes them plasticky. You can spray them and they stick, and they you know, when you squeeze a can, it doesn't crack or chip or crumble off. And to figure out how much of this coating to use, it turns out there's three different thicknesses they use on cans. I guess they call them A, B, and C. And something like beer doesn't need much coating because it's really mild. Something like, what would be next? Some soda might be next, and something really lemon limey, or something really dyed, something that's maybe bright green like Mountain Dew, would need the thickest coating. The problem is that a tiny, tiny bit of BPA or some component of BPA will migrate into the product. And the FDA regulates this by basically insisting that no more than half a part per billion is detectable in liquid. The problem is that there are scientists out there who say that this threshold is off by anywhere from 1 to 8 orders of magnitude, which means not just a half a part per billion, but like, you know, parts per quadrillion turn out to matter.
Wow.
And I talked to a guy who has patents on some of the coatings that they use in cans, because pretty much for everything out there, there's a coating specifically designed for it. And he told me that knowing what he does about these coatings, and the industry is very secretive, it's almost like fracking fluid, knowing what he does about coatings, he won't drink out of cans. He says he knows what can go wrong. He says he knows what can end up in beverages. So he won't allow cans of any type, food or beverage, in his house.
Well, as you say, one of the most engineered products in the world. Your book includes several poems. I don't know what rust and canning and rust inspectors has to do with poems. Let me just read one. This actually goes back to February 1918 at the annual National Canners Association in Boston. And this is Colonel William Grove recited this poem. It says, we can march without shoes, we can fight without guns, we can fly without wings, we can flap over the Huns, we can sing without bands, parade without banners, but no modern army can eat without canners. And, of course, the important role that cans played certainly in that war.
Right. Right. And was it Napoleon who said something like an army marches on its stomach?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Something
yeah.
like
so,
that.
And I like that quote because they didn't know about endocrine disruptors 100 years ago. It was just marvelous that you could put food in a can, seal it, and open it later, and not pick the ground for weevils and weeds that you can eat. And I guess the neat thing about being alive today is we're gathering so much information about these products that we can make and how they interact. And it turns out plastic might not be, we're still learning about endocrine
sure.
disruptors. And it's not just BPA. There's 500 other plastics that also have endocrine disrupting qualities. And I think if I were a woman, I'd be a lot more worried than as a guy. I will never be breastfeeding a child. But it still definitely concerns me. And everyone I tell about BPA and cans, they get kind of wide-eyed.
Well, let me get some callers in the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We have Amanda calling us from Marion Station. Amanda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I thought it was really interesting, the comparison that the author made at the beginning about how rust doesn't get as much attention as big, huge natural disasters, yet it's still a huge destroyer and a big, a big problem.
Sure.
So I'm wondering, how does rust compare to, big hurricanes and earthquakes that take a lot of lives? How life-threatening is rust?
Do you have the answer to that, Johnny? How life-threatening is rust?
Yeah, sure. So rust has felled bridges. It has knocked planes out of the sky. It's definitely... Ford recalled a bunch of automobiles because corroding cruise control switches could cause parked vehicles to catch fire. And, of course, corrosion has also caused axle failure, engine mm-hmm. failure. So I'm sure there have been some accidents attributable to that. The funny thing is, I'm sure it pales in comparison to a tsunami at sea level where thousands of people are. But as with most natural disasters, casualties and destructiveness have to do as much with what we build and where we live as with the actual force of nature. So, some people have told me, well, rust isn't a disaster because it's not, it's all our fault. But that's the same thing with, an earthquake. If you build a city on a fault line, that's also our fault.
Thanks for the call, Amanda. We have an email from Drew. He says, is stainless steel really stainless? Does it rust eventually?
It does rust. It just stains less than other steels. And there's something like, I like to think of stainless steel as something like whiskey. There's 100, thousands of blends and varieties, and some of them do well in salt water, some do terrible in salt water, some do well. Some are medical grade or marine grade, which probably costs even more, or aeronautical grade. But it was called stainless steel 100 years ago by a cutler who said, wow, this stuff stains less than other steels. And now, like I said before, we just take it for granted. We see forks and knives and keychains and escalator treads and scissors, and we just think, oh, yeah, metal, there it is. But but this would have baffled our great-grandparents.
Let me see what Hank from Germantown has to say. Hank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey there.
Hi there.
First off, congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
Yeah. So I had a question as a homeowner. I'm in Germantown. I've got a basement full of things that were left from the previous owner. A lot of rusty keys, rusty door hinges. Just curious, in your research for the book, did you come across any ways to easily de-rust items?
And the operative word is easily, right, Hank?
Yeah, easily. I just want to put it in something, come back 2 weeks later.
And all the rust is gone?
The guy to call is John Carmona of the Rust Store in Madison, Wisconsin. He fields these calls left and right, and he can tell you, this one for your tools, that one for your hinges, this one for your car. He's great.
Check it out. The Rust Store in Wisconsin. Hank, thanks for the call, and good luck. Good luck as well. Johnny, you tell an interesting story about the Statue of Liberty, and it wasn't until some illegal climbers got involved and started climbing the statue that they saw how serious a rust problem it was.
Yeah, two really great hippies from San Francisco came out to protest the imprisonment of a Black Panther. And they got caught climbing a statue. They were using big old suction cups. But their stunt sort of forced the superintendent of the park to take a look with a pair of binoculars at the statue, and they noticed all these holes. And at first, the Park Service accused the climbers of puncturing the statue using pitons and hammers. And they said, but we don't have any. We use suction cups. Here they are. And so they did some research, and they figured out that the statue was in terrible shape after about 100 years of almost no maintenance, or even maintenance that had the opposite of its intended effect. And so eventually Lee Iacocca was put in charge of this multi-hundred million dollar fundraising campaign and this five-year restoration, and the statue was kept. I mean, it was so bad that the torch was at risk of falling over. The frame of the statue was in structurally deficient condition. And it's just, you know, again, it's the same with a can, except it's a giant copper and iron statue right there in New York Harbor. What a crazy thing to try to do.
But they were able to fix it and, I guess, keep the maintenance up for it. Is there a cure for rust? Has anyone come up with a cure for rust?
I'm sorry to say there's no cure. It's like death and taxes. There's plenty. Dan Dunmeyer would love this. He wants to change the way the Pentagon thinks about rust. He wants to go from find and fix to predict and manage. And there are only so many things we can do to fight rust, but we can get a lot better at predicting and managing.
Do you think we should have more rust czars?
Definitely. That's actually, I think it was the National Academies did a study a couple years ago about a national approach to corrosion policy, and they said exactly that. They said we should have more guys like Dan Dunmeyer in a number of different federal agencies. And the details are eluding me right now, but yeah, absolutely. More guys like Dan. And they don't have to be engineers.
We began, and your book begins with this boat that you bought that was just riddled with rust. You still have the boat. Have you been able to address that problem?
Thank God I don't have the boat anymore. My buddy sailed the boat to Australia and sold her there. And I actually dedicate the book to whoever, I'll say idiot, whatever idiot bought the boat. I think a boat's a terrible idea. I am glad to be a landlubber and free of that boat. I learned a ton from it. I guess advice. I'm not in the business of offering advice, but if you want to go sailing, find a friend who has a boat and stick them with the rust problems.
I hear you. About a minute before I have to say goodbye on something completely different. Mm-hmm. Looks like you keep a monthly digest of goat news about goats. True, not true?
Oh, true. I do keep this digest. I mean, you probably know I'm obsessed and I'm kind of nerdy.
Join the club.
Yeah. The goats is, it's a thing to keep me attuned to the strange facts of nature that present themselves. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything unpredictable and crazy, it's goats.
Well, and apparently 2015 is the year of the goat, right?
That's right. You know, I've also been told that the cover of my book, that image by Alicia Eve Sook, that part of it actually looks like a goat. And now I'm wondering if there's a conspiracy at the publisher to put a goat on my book.
Well, on that note, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for the good questions, Marty.
You're welcome. Jonathan Waldman, author of a new book called Rust, The Longest War. And again, he has a monthly digest of goat news. He's written for Outside, The Washington Post, McSweeney's. We also spoke with photographer Alicia Eve Sook about her beautiful photographs of rust. And again, we have posted them on our Facebook page, just a few of them. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.